From the four corners of Southern California, this is The Hot Seat, and you're in it with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. On the phone, I have California State Assemblyman for the 10th District, Mark Levine. How are you, Assemblyman Levine? Thank you very much for calling into The Hot Seat today.
Oh, thank you so much, Max, for having me. It's a pleasure to join you today.
It's my pleasure, and we're very happy to have you. The 10th District essentially runs from parts of Santa Rosa between Rohnert Park and Freestone all the way down to San Rafael, going as far east as Sonoma and west to the Pacific Ocean. Is that correct?
Yeah, I like to describe it as from the northern point of the Golden Gate Bridge all the way to Santa Rosa, all of Marin and at the southern half of Sonoma County.
Okay. And you are the chair of the Water, Parks, and Wildlife Committee, and you are a member of the Higher Education Committee, Aging and Long-Term Care Committee, Arts, Entertainment, Sports, and Internet Media Committee, and Governmental Organization Committee. So I have lots of important questions and not a lot of time, so without further ado, let's get started. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Assemblyman Nazarian yesterday, who told me that the legislature special session isn't over, but it was intended for the purpose of funding transportation infrastructure improvements. And it is still ongoing, but there has yet to be a deal reached on how to fund this. Why? What are you doing to make a deal come out of this, and why hasn't there been a deal yet?
Yeah, so first of all, some member of Nazarian serves on the special session committee on transportation. He also serves on the regular session committee on transportation. He works very diligently on behalf of transportation issues, not just for his district in the Los Angeles area, but also the whole state. And he's been working very tirelessly on it. I serve on the special session committee on public health and developmental disabilities. And the special session committees were called by the governor to try to resolve some challenges we have specific to transportation. How do we have a defined revenue source for the state's transportation challenges? LA, San Francisco, San Jose are three of the top five worst traffic congested areas in the nation. And in my community, in the Bay Area, commuters spend almost 80 hours per year delayed in traffic. And this is twice the national average. And traffic congestion, specifically in the Bay Area, is at the highest level we've seen in the last 15 years. This congestion causes Americans about $124 billion in direct and indirect losses. That'll be expected to rise to about $186 billion in 2030. So just imagine that California's got three of the top five worst traffic congested areas. That cost to the state and to our households is astronomical. And so this special session was called to try to resolve that, but it doesn't mean that the legislature or that stakeholders have reached consensus simply because the governor calls the special session. We have identified the problem. You know, not only is traffic bad, but our roads are in gross disrepair. The deferred maintenance on our highways and roads in California is $6 billion annually, and on our local streets, another $8 billion. So while no deal was reached yet in the special session up to this point, you know, that doesn't mean that we're not going to continue working through the special session, which has not ended. It's very challenging because to create a reliable funding structure, we need to raise taxes, and that requires a two-thirds vote in the legislature.
Well, that's at least what the Democrats want to do. The Republicans are calling on other means to go about doing this. But in terms of, even though it's not over, up to now, would you consider the special session for transportation to be a failure because there hasn't been a transportation deal reached yet?
Oh, gosh, no. I think it's early on in the process. So we've identified the problem. There have been proposals to create a solution to that problem. Consensus has not been reached on whether any of those proposals will you know, gain the support that it needs, the critical mass of support that it needs. But this is a longer process, and the special session could go to as long as next August, and that gives us time to figure out what the right solution is.
Okay, and moving on now to water. And I wouldn't be doing my job if I wouldn't ask you about the drought because you are the chair of the Water, Parks, and Wildlife Committee. In a few short sentences, what is the state of the state when it comes to the drought, such as how much water we actually have, a specific number, and water infrastructure to catch rainwater?
Well, it's an interesting problem or question to ask, because listeners may be surprised that we don't really know or have reliable estimates as to how much water we have available and even how much water we need. This just simply isn't tracked efficiently and in a manner that gives us data that we can use in a simple way. But we can talk about what storage we do have in the state of California. So total statewide water storage is about 20 million acre feet, which doesn't include smaller dams and groundwater storage. So, for example, the Kern Water Bank alone is another 1.5 million acre feet. So,
when you say acre feet, for those who do not know, would you mind just explaining what 1 acre foot is the equivalent to?
That is about 380,000 gallons of water for, and I may be getting that number incorrect as I'm kind of going through all of these numbers. And each acre foot, each acre foot is able to provide water for how, you know, that many households. So it's not the easiest way for people to understand how that works. Let me see if I've got this data that's a little bit easier. So 1 acre foot is 325,851 gallons. So that's as specific as I can get.
Okay.
So if we look at, you know, the fact that we've got this much storage, the challenge for California is how do we catch the water as it falls on California? And what we've seen this past year is that we've got the lowest snowpack we've had, scientists say, in 500 years. We cannot rely on rain falling on the Sierra Nevada mountain range in the form of snow to then be slowly released over the course of a year. And then, of course, that as it's released, then flows into down the watershed into the storage that we have. So what are some things that we can do to put a little bit less reliance and stress on the Delta? And I think water recycling, particularly for Southern California and the Los Angeles area, would be beneficial not just for L.A., but for the state as a whole. If you look at the San Fernando Valley...
But is that actually in place right now, or is that on a wish list of things to do?
I think that it's a combination of things. So some communities are doing it very well, particularly Orange County. I think in Los Angeles, it's a work in progress, but it's on their radar. They know they've got a plan for this. If you look at the San Fernando Valley, there's about a 4 million acre-foot storage capacity in their groundwater aquifers. The problem is that the aerospace industry polluted toxins into that aquifer. It will cost about $1 billion to clean that up and recover about 1 million acre-feet of storage.
Were they fined for contaminating it?
We're going to have to go a little bit further back, because this goes back decades on how that worked. But what we need to do is, once we're able to recover about 1 million acre feet of that storage, we're able to recycle water in L.A. or actually catch rain as it falls in L.A. rather than releasing it into the Pacific Ocean, that we could then store that water in the aquifer. That would then reduce the strain and pressure on the Delta ecosystem of transporting 1 million acre feet down to Southern California. So there are huge benefits to LA, but also huge benefits to the environmental activists and people who really care about the Delta communities, who are concerned about the transport of water, or even how big should Delta tunnels be, which is one of the governor's proposals. And I think that there would be straight statewide benefits for this investment in the Los Angeles area.
And in terms of the number, you said we don't have an accurate number, an actual number on how much water we actually have. Isn't that something that you think a California agency should monitor accurately? And if so, are you proposing legislation?
We don't have one agency that provides water for everyone in California. So we can cobble together all of this data. So, for example, I live in Marin County. I've got the Marin Municipal Water District. I know that, for example, in August of this year, that we have 72.6% of capacity in our reservoirs, or 57,773 acre feet of water available, which is actually above the average of capacity. Water use in my local water district, ending on September 22nd, that's how specific we can get, averaged 23 million gallons per day, down from last year of 24.82 million gallons per day. So when we get to the district level, we can get to granular details. The problem is that we have hundreds of these districts throughout California, and we need to, and I think to your point, we need to work better to understand what our state needs are. But there's not really one state water project that can serve all of these water districts. So, for example,
but shouldn't there be one California agency that has the responsibility of monitoring the levels and getting all the data and putting it all in one place from all the different water districts in the state of California? Wouldn't that be the logical thing to do to have an accurate measurement?
I think it would be a good idea to have one place where this data is reported and we can understand what water use is like. And so it should be pretty simple using open data methods and using technology for agencies to be able to post on their website that gets fed into through a data feed, a website, so we can see what this is. So we have one big screen, and we know what's happening in the state of California. But the water that we use, for example, where I live, has nothing to do with the water being used in, say, Sacramento or Los Angeles, because it's a local watershed. So we have all of these really disconnected water districts that some do work more connected with one another and rely on partnerships with one another. For example, the one I live in does work with a couple of other water agencies on the North Coast and in the North Bay. But it's not as though we have a perfect water system where all of the information is easy to gather. But technology is here, and it's something that can help us do that. And I did propose legislation last year, and we're still working on it, the two-year bill, to help us gather data on water issues. And hopefully we'll end up being successful with it.
Okay, and speaking of going back to what you were talking about capturing rainwater, because what are we going to do, and what is the current plan if the pending El Nino that's supposed to happen doesn't go as far north to the Sierra Nevadas? How is Southern California going to be able to capture all that water?
Well, this is a very good question. In Los Angeles, it rained 2 inches in one day in September. 80% of that rainwater was washed off the sea through the storm drains. And this simply must change if California is going to have a sustainable water system. So we have to think long term. We're not going to be able to solve this by this year's El Nino, but we have to have a water system that is able to take advantage of every opportunity it can to reuse every drop of water.
Do you have a plan in mind?
Well, I think that, if you talk to leaders in Los Angeles, including Mayor Garcetti, they do want to become self-reliant and rely less on the state water system. And so they do have a plan in mind. I believe, one, stormwater catchment's got to be a priority, because we don't know where rain's going to fall, but when it does, we need to get it. And the second point is, of course, as I mentioned before, recycling water. We need to reuse every last drop. And when we do that, we also need to have the water storage capacity to then bank the water. And that's the plan for cleaning up the aquifer in the San Fernando Valley.
Okay. And moving on now, because we are running short on time, you also serve on the Higher Education Committee, and CSU administration pay has been under the microscope again because of the pay cap increase and the payment of a transition salary to the former president of San Jose State while he's serving as an advisor to the president of Afghanistan, his native country. Do you really think the pay cap for administrators should increase while staff salaries are not increasing, staff and faculty salaries?
Yeah, well, to begin with, I believe that all Californians should have a right to a higher education. If you qualify for the CSU or the UC or the community college, there should be a spot for you. It should not be a privilege available to only those who can afford it.
That's not the question at hand. The question at hand is, do you really think that there should be a pay cap, the pay cap for administrators should be increased?
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that, Max. So, given the perspective that I have about how higher education should be affordable to all who qualify for it, We do need to make sure that we're keeping that true. Relative to CSU compensation levels for administration, how that impacts that, some CSU campuses were charging additional fees to help cover those costs. I advocated against that. I don't believe students should have to bear that burden. And consequently, this year, the legislature passed AB 1000 to establish a framework that a CSU campus would have to go through in order to increase student fees. This framework must include student involvement and approval, and I happily voted for that legislation. I believe, though, that UC has a much more serious problem with compensation levels than CSU. And in fact, UC has received greater public criticism when it has tried to increase tuitions. I think that, you know, the UC regents may seem a bit out of touch with the populations they serve, and UC is going to continue to get this type of criticism. I also understand that they're trying to be competitive with private universities, but it's a public university, and people who are attracted to public universities aren't looking just necessarily at the bottom line, but also at the impact that they're having on the community. And that's something that we have that's very special, both at CSU and UC.
So in short, you're not in favor of administration pay increases if it leads to additional student fees and tuition.
That's right.
Okay. And moving on now to my last topic, which is Governmental Organization Committee, which deals with, among other items, public records and open meeting laws, such as the Brown Act. And it seems that when the Brown Act is violated, the governmental body gets a letter from a deputy district attorney, maybe a city attorney, and the body is told to correct the action. How come there is no punishment for violators, especially chronic violators?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, I served on the city council, and now I'm in the assembly, and the public absolutely has a right to know how its government operates. And this is achieved a couple of ways. One, open public meetings. Also, open public records. And so, you know, as we look at the application of the Brown Act, it's important for all of these public entities to respect it and adhere to it. And, you know, we have to look at the consequences of the Brown Act and whether or not people are following it and figure out what is the appropriate punishment for some of these violations.
So do you or do you not think that there should be actual punishment or a fine?
Do you have a specific type of punishment in mind?
Such as a fine that can be paid into a fund in the Public Integrity Unit in the Attorney General's office, or some sort of mandated additional public comment time, or perhaps removal of a public official from a body if that public official does a certain amount of commits a certain number of violations?
Well, I think that latter point is very important to emphasize, because the best way to hold violators accountable is at the ballot box and voting them out of office. The concept of fining a city council or a sanitary district board, I don't know what their right amount would be, you know, $500 for voting on something that's not agendized, is novel. But I think that also the consequences of the action that those boards have taken and how much they've hurt the public good would be an interesting concept to explore as well. But I don't think that's been the case as of yet.
Okay, and talking more about the Brown Act, why doesn't the Attorney General's office handle Brown Act cases? Isn't it a conflict of interest if it's a county district attorney who has to write a letter to the county board of supervisors? Because wouldn't the district attorney have an inherent reason not to call something a Brown Act violation?
I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I could understand that perhaps you would think a district attorney would have relationships with local boards or councils, and that would make there be an appearance of impropriety or a conflict, but I don't think that there would be a district attorney who would say that it would hinder their ability to apply the law as it should be.
Okay, and one final question on the subject of public records. What is your position on the California Supreme Court case, County of Los Angeles Board of Supervisors versus SCACLU of Southern California, which is about whether LA County's outside legal bills are subject to the California Public Records Act or whether they are attorney-client privileged.
Yeah, relative to the Los Angeles ACLU case, it's my understanding that the court ruled that legal bills are protected under attorney-client privilege.
The appellate court ruled that. The trial judge ruled it in favor of the ACLU.
Yes, and so the appellate court ruled that they are protected and are not subject to the Public Records Act. I don't necessarily agree with that decision. It seems to me that the attorney-client privilege is relative to issues related to legal advice, communications about litigation and such, not necessarily a bill for legal services. The decision came out in April, well past the bill introduction deadline in the legislature. However, I would be surprised if the legislature doesn't consider amending the act, the Public Records Act, to clarify whether legal bills are or are not protected by the attorney-client privilege. And I would suspect that would come from a Los Angeles member.
And you would want
to address that issue.
You would want legal bills to be subject to the PRA?
I think it's something to consider. We have to figure out, you know, how does this apply? How does this affect the court's ruling? And whether or not the cost of the legal advice rather than, the communications about the litigation communications, the legal advice and everything that would be protected, but that the cost wouldn't be. And there's no real, I don't know if there's a privilege that would be threatened by being open about the cost of these legal services. I don't believe the advice would be opened up to anyone to get an advantage over a public agency from that legal advice in any way. But it's all about the details.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, and thank you very much for joining me in the hot seat today, Assemblyman Levine. It was a pleasure. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so I can't ask any more questions. But the Hot Seat After Hour starts right now. You can email the Hot Seat inbox at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can subscribe to the Hot Seat newsletter by clicking on the link on our page. Go to annenbergradio.org/podcast and click on the link underneath the Hot Seat's description and enter your email address. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me next time with political reporter Dave Bryan.